Well, it's good to be with you and to share with you some results from the first 3 years of an experiment that we've been conducting in Temple, Texas. And really, I sort of feel like I'm preaching to the choir here, because the story behind this is that soils matter. And the soils matter to the extent that in many of the global change experiments that are conducted, they're done on a single soil type. And the inference is that we can make from those experiments are oftentimes limited to the soil on which the experiments are conducted. And so what I want to do today is share with you an experiment where we're actually looking at the impact of differences in atmospheric CO2 on three different soil orders that are found in Texas. And so why is it that we might suspect that soils matter? So this is a schematic that shows the potential impacts of changes in atmospheric CO2 on different soil and ecological processes. And so if you change atmospheric CO2, you're going to alter leaf level photosynthesis, which may impact plant growth. It's also been shown that the changes in atmospheric CO2 and changes in productivity will influence nutrient use efficiency within those plants, which changes patterns of soil or of bulk litter quality, influencing patterns of litter decomposition, the availability of soil nutrients, plant nutrient uptake. In a C3, C4 grassland, it can change the competitive balance between C3s and C4s. Changes in nutrient use efficiency and litter quality can alter patterns of plant and soil carbon, patterns of soil respiration that feeds back to atmospheric CO2. Well, one thing that we know is that soil type has an influence on things like available soil nitrogen, plant community composition. Something that we don't include in this original diagram is CO2's influence on water availability and water use efficiency. And so we should anticipate that soil type would make a big difference in how ecosystems respond to atmospheric CO2. And so the motivating questions for this study is to examine how the effects of changes from subambient concentrations of CO2 to superambient concentrations will influence ecosystem processes on ecosystems from different soil orders. And so how does soil order with its effects on water availability and nutrient dynamics influence ecosystem responses to changes in CO2? And specifically, see whether there are important thresholds or non-linearities in how grasslands respond to changes in atmospheric CO2. The experimental design, this is a system that has been in place. This is the second derivation of the field experiment. But we have a gradient in atmospheric CO2 that ranges from 250 parts per million to 500 parts per million, arrayed along two linear experimental units into one end. We inject air that is elevated in CO2, and as it flows along the length of the gradient, photosynthesis draws CO2 out of the air, and by altering flow rates of the air, we can maintain a constant gradient in CO2. And so along one leg of the experiment, we have CO2 concentrations from ambient to superambient, and then on the second one, we inject ambient air and draw it down to 250 micromoles per mole. The three soil types are all found within the region of Temple, Texas. We have amolisol, which is the Austin series, vertisol, which is the Houston series, and an alfasol, which is the Bastrop. The experimental design, we planted in a uniform plant community at the beginning, and then succession took place, and we had shifts in the dominant plants based on soil type, and that occurred prior to the initiation of the CO2 treatment. A little bit about the soils. Two of these soils, the Austin and the Houston, are actually part of a catena sequence. The upland soils have slightly lower clay contents than the toe slopes. The toe slopes are heavy clays, 53% clay. And then we have alluvial soils in the same region that have a much higher sand content. And so one thing to note is the need to distinguish between water content and water availability to interpret some of the results that we found. The two high clay soils that we have, the Houston and the Austin soils, both tend to have very high water content as compared to our bass strip, the sandy soil. But when we actually use moisture release curves to convert these numbers from water content to water potential, what we see is that consistently our vertisol, the high clay soil, has very low water potential. So the most water-limited system of these three soil types that get the same amount of precipitation are our high clay soils, as opposed to the sandy soils, which have a low water content but a relatively high water potential. On the plant communities, what we found is that prior to fumigation, there were differences in patterns of above-ground productivity. Our Austin soils, which have the intermediate texture, had the lowest above-ground biomass. They averaged about 230 grams per meter squared, as opposed to the Bastrop soils, which are 400 grams per meter squared, and the Houston, which are around 380. We also saw that the Austin soils were actually dominated by C3 forbs as opposed to the others, which were dominated by C4 grasses. And so if one was to develop hypotheses about which soils would be most responsive to changes in CO2, you can actually develop hypotheses for why each one of those would be most responsive. So you might anticipate that if CO2's primary effect was in changing water use efficiency, you would expect that the Houston soils with the lowest water potentials to be most responsive to CO2. You could also likely hypothesize that the Austin soils, which are dominated by C3s, might be more responsive because C3 photosynthesis tends to be more responsive to changes in atmospheric CO2. And the results show a really interesting temporal pattern. So looking at what happened between years 1 and 3 of fumigation, I think it is really telling as far as allowing us to determine some of the mechanisms responsible for this. And what we found is in the first year of fumigation that our Austin soils and the Houston soils both responded relatively quickly. So within the first year of fumigation, you started to see a CO2 response. So along the x-axis, we have growth CO2, and on the y-axis, we have above-ground net primary production in grams per meter squared. And so what we found is in the two high-clay soils, they responded relatively quickly to CO2, whereas in the sandier soil, there wasn't a CO2 effect. But over time, what we saw is that, in fact, the Houston soil became less responsive. And so the initial slope relative to CO2 was high in 2006, and by 2008, the slope was only marginally significant. When we looked at the influence of CO2 on nitrogen availability, we see an interesting pattern. And this is something that we saw in the first experiment that we did, that was finished in 2001, and that is that in these high clay soils, we tend to see a CO2 influence on nitrogen availability. And in fact, what we saw when we break this down, subambient, and here we are measuring nutrient availability using ion exchange resins, and what we saw is that at subambient concentrations, we have twice as much nitrate as we do under elevated conditions, and the same is true for phosphorus. And so we see that as you expose these systems to elevated CO2. This is over 3 years. After 3 years, we see a diminishment in the nutrient availability at high CO2. If you look at them for specific months, what we see is in the middle of the growing season, total inorganic nitrogen, you see that there's a decrease in nitrogen availability with CO2 concentration, and in September, the relationship is actually nonlinear. Alexia Kelly, who is a postdoc working in Rob Jackson's lab at Duke, did some soil enzyme assays to try to see the enzymatic mechanism for these decreases in nutrient availability with increases in CO2. And for the soil enzymes responsible for nitrogen availability, there's a pretty interesting pattern here. And these come from 2008. And what we see is that the aminopeptidase activity in the Houston soils declines. This is entirely consistent with the ion exchange resins that we measured. So as you see a decline in nitrogen availability, you also see a decline in aminopeptidase activity, which is fairly counterintuitive. You would figure if you had decreases in nitrogen availability, you would increase microbial enzyme activity. But you didn't. But what you did see is that the glucosaminidase, which is responsible for chitin degradation, is actually increasing. And so potentially what we're seeing is a shift in substrate. And so they're shifting from relatively labile nitrogen sources to more recalcitrant nitrogen sources as nitrogen availability decreases. Phosphatase activity is what you might anticipate, which is that as phosphorus availability decreases, you would increase phosphatase activity, and we did see that over those months where we saw CO2 effects on phosphorus availability. So in synthesis, if we look at these three different soil types, we see that the Austin soil, the mollisol, typically had among the highest water potentials. Over time, ANPP became more responsive to changes in CO2, but you don't see a nitrogen feedback, a nutrient feedback in it. The Houston soil was the one that was most interesting. It's the one where we have the lowest water potential. We see that net primary productivity is less responsive to CO2 over time, and this corresponds with changes in nitrogen availability. And we think that we can explain at least part of this as a shift in enzyme activity between labile and recalcitrant sources. In the Bastrop soil, the one that had highest water potentials, we saw that there was a delay in its responsiveness to CO2, and that there was a change in phosphorus availability that corresponded to changes in soil enzyme activity. The bottom line results, though, are soils matter, right? And that if we're going to interpret these large-scale global change experiments, we have to understand that the way that we interpret them are contingent upon the soil on which the ecosystems are developing, and that we can see fast responses or slow responses that on soils that are found in the same region. And so interpreting, we need to be careful in how we interpret these results. And in this system in particular, what we found is that water availability seems to be a controlling factor in how the systems respond to CO2. Thanks.
We have time for a couple of questions.
Well, if that activity is interesting, it seems like over, if you just made the observations over narrower ranges than CO2 concentrations, you would have the exact opposite conclusion than we did. I wonder if you could comment on some of the
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And this is one of the things that has been interesting to come out of our earlier study as well, is that including a subambient concentration as a way to orient the system, to know that these systems develop under lower CO2 concentration, is important. And in fact, what we found is that in our system in particular, that it's much more responsive as you go from 385 to 250 than it is going 385 to 550. And so the most responsive part of that range with water use efficiency, with nutrient availability, it has consistently been over the range that has that the change that we've seen historically compared to what we're forecasting into the future. And so that's another point of interpretation. We oftentimes say, okay, where ambient is sort of the historical, and we're going to look into the future, but in fact, the systems that we're dealing with now have over relatively short time frames, have experienced a major atmospheric perturbation.